Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael, and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today, we'll be discussing three topics. Firstly, we'll discuss Bola Tinubu's cabinet nominees. The deadline was Thursday, the 28th, I believe. He sent a list of 28 individuals to the Senate for approval. Secondly, we'll discuss the appearance in court of the suspended governor of the central bank, Godwin Emefiele. I'll discuss the drama around his court appearance. And finally, we'll discuss the recent coup d'etat in Niger Republic and its implications for the Sahel region and Nigeria. So to the first topic, Phoenix, I'm trying to understand. Tinubu sent 28 names to the Senate for cabinet nominees. But my understanding is that, first of all, the Constitution requires you to send one minister per state. So that should be about at least 36. So 36 names should have been sent to the Senate. So that's sort of the first question to get clarification on that. And secondly, did the names of the nominees fill you with any sort of excitement or hope that this would be a serious government, Phoenix?
Hi, Michael. It's good to have you back. Glad to hear that you did go to Lagos. And I hear there was a lot of enjoyment there, and you made it back in one piece. So it's good to have you back. I'm sure the listeners are also happy to hear from you, because most folks were busy sending us messages like, guys, what's going on? But we're glad to hear from our listeners and the loyalty that they share. So that's great. Hi, listeners. And for me, I mean, to your point about the constitutional requirement, I think there were a number of things around that we needed to talk about. I think, first of all, the list of 28 was explained as a first list, because even in that 28, there were a number of names that were from the same state. So clearly, we are going to have more than 28, and I expect a follow-up list. I think the issue that they had was I think the National Assembly had also rejigged this and gave a deadline. So there's a deadline that you must submit your ministerial list within 60 days of being sworn in. And we know that he hit that mark, I believe it was on Friday, which was July, what's today? And so it was yesterday, July 29, ostensibly. So he had to put something in. So he sent that list of 28. So that's not the list of all the ministers he's going to have. And we also heard from what's his name, chief of staff, Femi Gbajabiamila, who did say that there are going to be more ministries and all of that. So to all those who were hoping that Tinubu will run a lean government, fair chance. But to your second question, Andy, did it fill me with any excitement? No, it did not. I mean, not that I was expecting anything better, but it was even worse than I imagined it to be. I think short of a couple of names that you could say are really technocrats, so maybe Pate, the party, what's his name, Adilabu, who used to be the deputy governor in Central Bank. You have Edun, who perhaps this ends all of the speculation about him being looked at as CBN governor, given that he's been put on the ministerial list, but maybe it's for now until they can resolve the Emefiele issue. But apart from that, it was just a list of politicians. And then you see four governors or four people who used to be governors, and it just tells you that part of what they were selling with the Tinubu candidacy was that he's a good he knows how to choose great talent. People were pointing to his first cabinet when he became governor, which is true. He did have a lot of technocrats. He did have a lot of experts, and he had some good outcomes. So people expected that that would be the case this time around. But this list is very underwhelming, even for him in this current state, and it just tells you that these guys are not prepared for anything, any positive outcome under this administration. We wait to see what the second list will be. If you remember last time, I made the comment saying I expect to at least have some technocrats, that I expect that he will try to balance it out. We do see that some names are missing, so Ganduje is not on the list, as most people would have expected. So maybe the rumors were true, but the fact that he has this list is just underwhelming. I was saying that I think it sends a message to me, you know, confirming almost confirming some of my initial thoughts that people who are technocrats, people who could try to burnish the credentials of this regime, might be keeping a wide berth for now. One, because of course there's the election tribunal and there's all the story about legitimacy and all those kind of things. So unless you are beholden to Tinubu, you won't be jumping on the bandwagon right now. And perhaps that's what we see from this first list. We wait to see what will be in the second list. And then maybe that may look better than this. But this is not what Nigeria needs at this time.
Thank you, Phoenix. But first issue I need to address is because I've read some of the commentary on the nominees and the likes of even Simon Kolawole, who writes one of the prominent political journalists in Nigeria, and I believe Segun Adeniyi have both made the point that Tinubu has committed a constitutional infraction by not delivering the 36 names because apparently the provision does not give the room for sort of an interim list. You need to submit the 36 names by the deadline. So is this a positive sign, or doesn't this raise issues about his commitment to the rule of law and the constitution?
It does raise issues, but by now we must be clear in our minds that this guy does not care about rule of law. And I know we'll talk about Emefiele, but that's a clear pointer to that. I think the question is, who's going to hold him accountable? Is it going to be the National Assembly, or do ordinary Nigerians have to, you know, sue him to court and say, this is what the constitution. Because I've never read that piece and what the consequences for not meeting that deadline is. I mean, but clearly he was supposed to submit within 60 days, and the fact that he only submitted 28 names is true. He has not met the requirements. But the question is, what's the remedy? What can be done? And maybe I'll look into that to see if there were any remedies stated by the National Assembly in the current guise with Godswill Akpabio as Senate President, who's going to Senate sessions wearing a Tinubu cap. I mean, really, what are we expecting?
I suppose the next question, videos have been circulated on the internet showing the likes of Governor Nasir El-Rufai, former Governor Nasir El-Rufai and former Governor Nyesom Wike, both boasting that they would never accept ministerial appointments. On Wike's point, he said he would never take a job from the APC. On El-Rufai said he's too old, that it's unfair, that at his age, why should he be a minister? That even if he's nominated, it's better for someone younger to get the position. So their views or their positions on being ministers seem categorical, that they would never accept it. So can you sort of explain what is this about turn that both of them seem to be making?
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen if they accept the appointments, right? I mean, their names are on the list. one presumes that they will have been spoken to by Tinubu. And remember, especially in the case of El-Rufai, I remember when they went to Chatham House and Tinubu called him out to answer a question, and then there was another meeting, or whether it was the same meeting, where he told him he can't go away after his term of office, he's going to stay to help. So Tinubu has been very upfront that he wants El-Rufai in his government. So it was not a surprise to see his name on the list. Yes, on Wiki, we knew that he would have to get some reward for the role that he played. Now the question is whether, I mean, they will accept the appointment or they will beg off. Again, I'm saying that I presume that they've had the discussions and they've accepted already, and they will take those positions, because why make a fool out of the president and somebody who's supposed to be, you know, your who you helped get into office, if you know you're not going to take it? So it would just be, you know, the average fare of the Nigerian the regular fare of the average Nigerian politician going back on their word is something that they're used to, and speaking from both sides of their mouth. So I don't put much stock in what they've said before. I would not be surprised if they accepted the appointments and stepped into the roles. The question now becomes what portfolios will they be given? I think that's what will be quite interesting, having seen the list that has gone out.
And then for El-Rufai in particular, he has made a lot of divisive, hateful, and extremist comments over the years. The last of them was him boasting that this government is going to show that the Muslims dominate the country. You know, that sort of talk of ethnic and religious superiority in the past. He was one of the key players in the massacre of the Shiites, or the murder of the Shiites in Kaduna State. Other times he accused Christians and Igbos and Niger Deltans of supporting Boko Haram. So a number of people have said, why would Bola Tinubu bring this sort of character into office? Can you shed light on what is going on, Phoenix?
Bola Tinubu has proven that he's a political animal first and foremost, and all that is important to him is power, not necessarily doing what is good. We did see Bola Tinubu choose to go for a Muslim ticket. We did see all of the issues that happened during the election season in Lagos. We saw the ethnic baiting that went on, particularly just spearheaded by the Tinubu APC campaigns and all that. So to assume that Bola Tinubu would then walk away from El-Rufai, I mean, that was never going to happen. He was going to embrace him, and he was going to, as long as it was going to strengthen his hand and help him achieve his own aim of whatever helps him be powerful, he was going to therefore do that. And so, I mean, we should not ascribe any high moral fiber to Tinubu. He is all about, you know, by any means necessary and acquiring power. So this is a man who is in it for himself and who doesn't care how this affects the fabric of a fragile nation. I've said it repeatedly. A person like El-Rufai should be nowhere near public office in Nigeria, not after all the things that he did, especially this year, especially in this political season. He dug in, you know, perhaps realizing that he was, after all he had done to create rancor in his state in the last 8 years, you know, after he had done to marginalize Christians in the state, you know, to treat the people of Southern Kaduna badly, and then all the attacks that he was making against the Igbos. I mean, this is not someone who, if we truly care about the unity of Nigeria, should be close to the seat of power and be an influential person or a part of the leadership. But Tinubu, you know, accepts all comers. So this should not surprise anyone.
And then there's the nominee from Taraba State, Sani Damladi. That's another controversial figure. From reading the news, he was disqualified from, I think, contesting for an election in Taraba State because he presented fake or forged documents. He then appealed his case all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld his disqualification because he presented forged documents. But for reasons nobody can quite understand, the Vanguard is reporting that he then got an order from the High Court overruling the Supreme Court's disqualification of his candidacy. And a number of senior lawyers at the time said, this is basically ridiculous, and that High Court judge should be reported to the National Judicial Council. But it appears nothing happened. Now, this same Damladi has now appeared on the ministerial list, which some are saying indicates that he clearly has some sort of strange hold on the party. Now, setting aside the argument of whether or not being disqualified for forging documents means you're also banned from ever holding any political office, surely, Phoenix, there's a moral question mark over making that sort of character a minister, isn't there?
Absolutely, there is. But it goes back to the point I was just making. I mean, looking to Tinubu to make sound moral judgments is a fool's errand. I mean, the guy himself is facing a challenge to his legitimacy based on his checkered past. So to expect that he will then be the one that will stand on high moral ground. And this is what we're talking about. You know, I think you raise a great point about the hold, you know, leverage. This is what we're talking about. When you have compromised characters who get into public office, there will be people who have a hold on them. There will be people who have leverage on them. And how does that play in Nigeria's favor? You have somebody who's sitting as president today with such a checkered past. Who are those who have a hold on him that can get him to do things that can be inimical to Nigeria's well-being? And so when you see people like this sort of character making his way into a ministerial list, you're like, what game are they playing? But again, I was talking about the National Assembly and the state of the National Assembly. This sort of person should clearly not have made the list. And even if he made the list, by the time he's getting to the National Assembly, I expect this person not to be confirmed. But I would be surprised if that doesn't happen, you know, if this person doesn't make it through. But I mean, we're in very dangerous times, because this is signaling, this is sending a message that it doesn't matter, that it's okay to be bad, to do wrong things, and that you will get rewarded. And think about the message that sends to young people. Think about the message that sends to those who are working hard to live a decent life. We're a country of 200 million people. You cannot reward bad actors and think that the country will remain at peace with itself and it will progress in the right direction. You can't. And so this was exactly the reason why I was vehemently against a Tinubu presidency. I mean, this is the decadence that we can expect. And I mean, it's amazing.
And then the final issue is the number of people have raised is this question of sending the names of nominees without portfolios attached. That isn't it time that the Senate puts a stop to it and says, look, if you're going to send us the name of nominees, tell us which ministries you're sending them to, because it means we're just asking aimless questions of these candidates, because even we ourselves don't know what positions they're going to be assigned. So what is stopping us from, or President Tinubu, or any president, from literally assigning a portfolio to the names when they're sent?
I think it's because no one has challenged them. We haven't seen a National Assembly that has refused to accept the least. I mean, we've seen other people before Tinubu do the same. Buhari did the same. I don't recall if Jonathan or Yadwa or OBJ did the same. I haven't dug deep into that, but I do remember that Buhari did the same. And it's number one. So long as it's not in the constitution that when you send the ministerial list, you have to put the position, it creates a loophole for them to work with. It now depends on the Senate and who you have there, who can push back and say, no, we will not consider a list that doesn't have clear portfolio for each person that you've named. But it also speaks to the issue at hand. You have a list that is 90% plus full of politicians. Doesn't really matter what portfolio. It's when you take the job seriously that this is part of the thing that just infuriates me, in the sense that we're told that this guy was prepared, he understood the issues and was going to come in. If he was prepared, surely he should have known, I mean, all the ministries that we have, or all the ministries that he was going to have, because there's nothing to holding him and saying that you must go and use the same ministries that Buhari had. The only thing that the constitution says is that every state must have a minister. It doesn't mean that it must be. You can reduce to 18 ministries and have two ministers, or you can reduce to 12 and have three ministers from three different states. And reduce, we kept saying, you need to reduce the thing. But once you've done that, if you were clear of what ministries that you needed to have to run an effective government, then you should also be clear about who are the, you know, experts who have led in such areas, who can come in and bring, you know, leadership experience and technical expertise to a certain degree. Surely, I'm not going to employ a minister for economic planning and budget who has no clue, or a minister for finance who doesn't know what they're doing. Or, you know, yes, they're leadership positions, but at least they must have some degree of experience in leading within that sphere. And that, if you were clear on that, then the names that you bring forward, it should be easy for you to attach the portfolios that they're going to hold. But this is a list full of politicians, and so they can throw them anywhere and expect them, okay, just go sit in the seat and, you know, do whatever you're going to do.
Oh, I see. And then finally, there's this nominee that has also generated some interest. Her name is Stella Okotete. She's apparently from Delta State. When she was nominated, she posted a video on the internet speaking in what I will describe, or what the Bible will call, unknown tongues, speaking in unknown tongues, celebrating her nomination. But within short notice, all kinds of petitions were seen online alleging that her qualifications were not up to scratch. So there seems to be a pattern, don't you think, of a number of politicians nominated by the APC whose documents or whose qualifications don't seem to be watertight. Why is this, Felix? Because I know we've had many other governments, but this level of alleged dodgy qualifications seems to have taken a new low since the APC came in 2015. Is there something? Is there more to it?
Yeah, my theory has always been that this was an SPV that just clubbed all sorts of people together, and there wasn't any real party discipline, right? Everyone just, you know, came together to remove PDP, but kept their own cliques within the party, and there wasn't a strong party structure to bring all the different ones groups together and have a clear ethos, have a clear, you know, way that you have discipline, that you have, you know, that you vet your candidates, that you hold people to account internally before you present them. So that's why you find all sorts of people have gone up through their ranks. No one has, you don't have a party without proper party discipline, without people who are looking at people who are looking at their rank and file and making sure that whoever gets to, you know, either vie for political office or be put up for appointments meet the muster. They're not a proper party, and we saw that, you know, over the years of the Buhari presidency and even leading to the primaries that they had, you know, in the run up to this election, and how disorganized, and how, you know, you had their party chairman proclaiming somebody when their NWC was saying something, when their governors were saying something. So this, I mean, to think that the APC is a is just a vehicle, and that's all. And that's why you see all sorts of people can make it through, because this is not to say that we have, you know, great parties. But like you said, we've had other governments. They've had their own shenanigans. They've had their own thing. But it is at a higher level, all of these issues that we're seeing with the APC.
Oh, yes. No, it's, hopefully, somebody will help us shed some light on what is going on. But on to the next topic, which is the governor of the central, or the suspended governor of the central bank, Godun Emefiele, appeared in court. So first of all, his outfit. I'm not quite sure what he was supposed to be dressed as. I don't know if it's he was supposed to be an Islamic cleric or somebody from the, what they call the Celestial Church of Christ. Those days with their white garments. And then he was carrying a Bible. I don't think I've seen a Bible that size ever before. King James version of the Bible. Then appeared in court, was apparently supposed to be granted bail and handed over to the prison service. But all of a sudden, there was a huge fight outside the courtroom with the DSS and him. His DSS officials were in a fight with the prison officials. People's shirts got torn, guns were cocked at each other. So can you talk us through, Felix, what was happening, starting from Emefiele's outfit to the fight outside the courthouse?
So now you want to turn me into fashion police. I have no idea what he was on about with that outfit. But you know, people find religion after they've done nonsense. So that's what we see. And perhaps it's a pointer that Emefiele needs Bible with large text for him to read. That's why he had the Bible of that size. But I mean, I hope his newfound faith, or maybe he always had his faith, but this fervor stands him in good stead. I mean, we're again seeing the DSS in their bumbling self. You know, you've kidnapped a guy, you've held him for a while, you didn't charge him to court, you have now been forced to charge him to court. The allegations that you made against him at the beginning are not the basis for what you're charging him for. And we're finding out that, I mean, he was granted bail and DSS was attempting to, you know, rearrest him, and they were, you know, battling with the correction services guys on who was going to take him into custody. So you find all of these things happening because, again, we're having a high-profile case that is being messed up because there's clearly political undertones to it. And that's what we're seeing here. If you have a clear case against him, let the courts do their job. This should already, if it's a firearms issue, you hand him over, especially because you're just talking about one firearm, not that he had a cache of arms. It should be a police matter. But you find that the DSS, which is clearly acting on the orders of the executive, is looking to make sure that he doesn't get off the hook and that they continue to put pressure on him for their ends. And that's what we saw with all the drama that was happening outside of the courtroom and all the issues that we see around this case. It's going to be another one that they're going to mess up. Just recently, we heard that the DSS were trying to smuggle in another order to keep him for another 14 days, which was denied by I believe, a high court or something like that. It's just a complete mess.
Oh, yes. And then the DSS subsequently issued a statement, but a lot of Nigerians, they seem quite understand what they were saying, because on the one hand, they said they were investigating the incident, that they saw it themselves, and then they alleged that there's a plot to smear or damage, destroy the reputation of the DSS by outsiders.
Well, they're doing that by themselves.
And then they said they are committed to the rule of law, but they seem to not engage with the question of how then have you held Emefiele contrary to the order of the court? They never seem to address that question. So, Kayon, Nigerians are trying to understand, like, when did the DSS get into this business of arresting and prosecuting offences that should ideally have been left to the police or the EFCC? How did this come about, Phoenix?
As far as I'm concerned, the DSS has lost its way, because for some time now, and even under the PDP, we've seen the DSS be used as a personal, as a personal force of the presidency, depending on whoever is pulling the strings. And sometimes the president might not be even aware or might be fully aware, but yes, it has become a personal force that is used, you know, whenever they want to do something that they also know is not in line with law. Because there are certain things you cannot simply use the police to do. That will be very obvious that they contravene the Police Act. But you can try and package something as national security leaning and then use the DSS, you know, and try to, you know, hoodwink the courts or hoodwink the public and say, oh, the DSS is handling because there's a national security issue there. So we've seen that happen under, you know, successive governments. I mean, Marilyn Ogar's high-handedness was well reported under Jonathan. We saw significant worsening of the use of DSS under Buhari, with them, you know, breaking down justices, breaking into justices' homes and kidnapping them in the middle of the night, you know, arresting and rearresting people, and you know, just flouting court orders. People will be granted bail; they will not be let go. And of course, Tinubu has come in now and is also using the DSS for his end, and particularly in this case versus Emefiele. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the DSS is not has since lost its shine, in any case, even if we look further back, you know, to SSS, to NSO, and all those times, there was a time when it was the NSO that it was still professional. But I think over time, you know, even from military around IBP to Abacha and all of that, and it just became the president's henchmen. And that's how they are today. That is one institution that truly needs to be
Phoenix, are you there?
That truly needs to be reformed and put in order. If you left it to me, I would totally disband them and set up something totally different, because I don't even think that those guys can be reformed.
Oh, no, thank you. Then I suppose the other issue around this Emefiele drama is, how long are they going to hold him for? Or if the aim is to get him to step down, why not just ask him to resign? Why this whole daily theatrics where he's being held and the only thing they've accused him of so far is that he possesses a Dane gun? Why are they doing this, Phoenix?
I'm sure they'd like him to resign. But at the same time, I'm sure they also want to ensure that there's a transfer of his loot to other parties. I mean, there must be some deals that are going on that needs to ensure that not only does he leave office, but also ensures that he pays. But I believe that there's also a vendetta part of it, which is to make sure that a pound of flesh is taken out of him by the Tinubu camp, you know, given how the elections went, and particularly when he spearheaded the change of currency and Tinubu said this was against him and all of that. So there must be some of that in the mix. But I mean, to your point, it is a clear case that we need to make sure that this is resolved as soon as possible, because there's the bigger issue of the lacuna in the CBN. We are without a governor and leadership at a very critical time for the economy and for the central bank, where we've been dealing with this, you know, Naira exchange rate issue and things like that.
Phoenix, I think we've lost you again.
There's a clear issue that, can you hear me?
Oh yes, we've got you back. I think we lost you for a few seconds.
So for me, that's a bigger issue, and they need to sort out themselves. I mean, you know, do whatever deal you need to do with him. Of course, he's not going to want to relinquish that easily, and therefore still be held or lose his freedom. So I'm sure he's also negotiating and trying to make sure that he holds an ace that protects him as well, but they need to sort this out so that at least the economy can move forward with clear leadership at the head of the CBN. That's the primary issue that needs to be resolved, and they need to take their nonsense elsewhere and not burden Nigerians with the games that they're playing.
And Peter Obi was in a space, the opposition candidate for the Labour Party was in a space yesterday, and he made a point about the fact that one of the assets that America has is the rule of law. And what I want your views on is, why don't the Nigerian legal profession seem to take the rule of law seriously? Because I'd have expected that if a court has given an order that somebody should be released, or at least bail should be arranged, and this sort of drama takes place in their courthouse, one would have expected that the judge himself would have ordered the DSS to come into his court and explain themselves, even order the arrest for contempt. And then secondly, one would have expected that senior Nigerian lawyers, both the Nigerian Bar Association, Committee of the Association of Judges, and all lawyers would condemn this behavior in the strongest terms, because it seems to be bringing their profession into disrepute. But why don't we seem to get that level of outrage when these things are happening in Nigeria, Phoenix?
Michael, if I could answer that question, I would. I think the biggest issue is, the biggest issue for me is the judiciary itself. You just talked about, I mean, earlier, about the fact that someone was able to procure a high court ruling against a matter already decided by the Supreme Court. I mean, that it just blows my mind that that's even possible, that a justice of the high court or judge of the high court would in their right mind do something like that without fear of what the repercussions will be, and that there has, so far as I'm aware, there has been no repercussion, or maybe I don't know what has happened. That's the starting point. Number one, you have the people who are, I mean, in the judiciary, who have over time not held up to the standards that they should have, number one. Then, of course, number two, you have the executive, which has, you know, blatantly refused to, you know, follow the tenets of the rule of law. And we've seen that repeatedly, but it worsened dramatically under Buhari. And now we're seeing, you know, Tinubu in the first 2 months were seeing the issues with Emefiele and the way he was picked up and being held and things like that. And you're like, over time, Nigerians are becoming inured to the fact that, look, there is no rule of law in Nigeria. It's like anything goes. And we also see it in private life. We see people who have a civil dispute who would run and go and call police and, you know, give them money to harass their fellow Nigerians and things like that. So we've built a society that has lost or hasn't been able to build that that culture of, you know, law and order, and the different fabrics of that society, the judiciary, the police, the lawmakers themselves have done more than their fair share to bring about the situation that we have, and we the people have just accepted it and rolled with it. And so, I mean, that was why, for me, we needed a political solution to solve for it. You needed to begin to put the right type of people into office who would then help to build back those institutions, who would help to ensure that all of those areas that we're talking about that have been affected, the judiciary, the police, you know, all of those kinds of things, will be put in the right place to do the right thing. But, I mean, right now, we're again at the mercy of the courts, you know, to see how things can be turned around to make sure that we get a positive outcome. Otherwise, you know, the morning shows the day. You can already see how Tinubu is going to run this country if he is allowed to remain in office. And Peter Obi was right. You don't build a society can only be built on rule of law, on if you and I trust that, yes, if we sign a contract and you go against that contract, it will be upheld. That is the basis for human relationships. And you cannot have any progress without that fundamental belief that contracts are, that there's a sanctity of contracts, that there's clear remedies when things are not happening the right way, that people will be treated fairly before the law. You cannot have a society. That is why, you know, Western society progresses. That is why people are willing to invest. That is why people are willing to be innovative, to pursue, because they believe that, yes, if I go out and do a venture, if I go out and, you know, build something, that I'm protected by law, I'll be treated fairly, we're all equal. But in a situation where that is not the case, who is going to come and invest? That's why our economy is struggling. When we go out to borrow, that's part of the premium that gets priced into our debt and makes it more expensive than other countries because they are worried about the rule of law. You see, airline companies are struggling to get their money out of Nigeria. You see, different companies taking us to court because we are flouting contracts. So, you know, those things have a way of creating problems for any country. And that's a big reason why Nigeria is struggling.
Thank you, Phoenix. And I suppose this brings me to our next issue, which is the military coup d'etat in Niger Republic. I've been reading news reports and commentaries, and the general consensus seems to be that democracy and the rule of law is on the decline in West Africa, especially the sort of Sahel region. And this seems to be causing a lot of concerns in Western capitals because of the fight against Boko Haram and extremism that seems to be highly concentrated in the sort of Sahel region. So the first question is, if you were president of Nigeria and the National Security Advisor, would you be worried that Niger has fallen into the hands of the military?
Yes, I would be. I mean, for me, we need to be very clear. When anything that happens, you know, around your territory is a concern to you. So when we've been having issues in Cameroon, of course, our national security advisor should be worried because, number one, you can have some of that violence spilling into your country. Number two, you can have heavy migration of refugees who are fleeing from the violence into your country. So, you know, having Niger, you know, falling into the hands of the military, which creates a situation of instability, because, you know, we know what happens, you know, after coups. It's the government becomes fragile. It's a vulnerable moment for any military junta, because they're always worried, okay, we've done a coup. Who's next that may try to do a coup, or who's an external aggressor who will take the opportunity of that instability to wreak havoc? We also know that Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso, all those countries connected, is where we see the playground of all these extremists and all the issues that have been happening, which is part of the reasons that the military was adducing for taking over, even though those reasons make no sense, because at least the Nigerians were handling it better than those other two countries. So yes, as a national security advisor of Nigeria, you should be worried that a state that borders you has suffered a coup. And you should be, you know, keeping your eyes peeled and trying to understand what is potentially going to happen, especially with the kind of responses that we're seeing from, you know, international, from other countries, from ECOWAS, from the AU and all of that, who are making clear demands of a return to civilian rule. So clearly there's going to be a lot of instability. Clearly there might be some strife, some infighting, you know, that may happen. So yes, it is something that should bother Nigeria and bother us from a national security perspective.
And a number of commentators, including the university lecturer Ayo Shogunro and the other commentator Chike Chukwudebelu, they made reference to the fact that across Africa, coups tend to happen in patterns, or they tend to follow each other, copycat coups. So once one country falls, within a few years, another one falls, and all of a sudden, coups become popular again. And they've said Nigeria itself should be worried that, given that some countries who are close to us are falling under the spell of military coups, that there's a risk that the same could happen in Nigeria, given the circumstances. One of them highlighted the fact that during the previous coups, first of all, the government appeared illegitimate. There was an economic crisis, corruption was an all-time high, and these are the conditions that encouraged the military to intervene. So do you think they are right to be concerned that the same could happen in Nigeria?
I think it is a valid point that copycat coups happen. So it's a valid point of reference. But my point of divergence is where is the inference that because a coup has happened in Niger, that could then happen in Nigeria. I think we're in a different space. I think, yes, the legitimacy of the current president is in question, but I don't think we're in a place where, it can be very easy for a coup to happen. I just think that we've been restructured so much from a military perspective that it's not that easy, given the size, given the scale, for that to happen. Now, does that mean I'm saying it can never happen? No, I'm not saying, never say never, but I think, we've had coups happen all across West Africa, right? So And that hasn't led to a coup in Nigeria. We've seen it in Mali. We've seen it in Gambia. We've seen a number of things happen that haven't led to a coup in Nigeria, for the reason that, I mean, we had that commitment to democracy, and we've seen our military be reshaped in a different way that makes it very difficult to simply just use the country. And so I'm not sure that is the risk that it portends for Nigeria. But I think that there are political ramifications, in the sense that, for example, Nigeria is current chairman of the ECOWAS community. The question is, with an illegitimate president, or with a president who has a tinge of illegitimacy around him, how is he able to garner support and, you know, speak with moral clarity and the right, and, you know, to galvanize, you know, support against coups or against typical things like that happening across the sub-region and the continent at large? That's always going to be the challenge that you have. People will always point to you and say, yeah, a stolen election is as good as a coup. So you're not exactly without blemish. And so it's very difficult. And that's part of what we will deal with. But I don't believe, just looking at the situation, looking at comparing Nigeria to some of these other countries, I don't see how today, I don't see us being in that space. Now, if things continue to get worse and there becomes a lot of civil unrest, perhaps we might begin to move away from where we are today to a situation like that. But I think where we are as a nation, the journey of the last 24 years, the kind of military that we have today, I find it very hard to see that happening.
And then the other question is, what role Russia is playing in this mess? Because some commentators have made reference to the fact that West Africa, or the Sahel region, seems to be the new front in this war between the West and Russia. And Russia seems to be discreetly backing military coups, hoping that those countries will fall into their orbit as opposed to the West's orbit. And the question then for Nigeria is, how would you advise Bola Tinubu and Nuhu Ribadu, his national security advisor, to navigate this sort of delicate balance to avoid falling either way? Or should we, perhaps, do you think Nigeria should fall in one way or the other into one of the camps? And then secondly, there's the fact that the US's drone base is in Niger, and it's those drones that are helping in the fight against Islamists. And if that state has fallen into the hands of Russia, then doesn't that open us up to, or Nigeria up to, more attacks from Boko Haram and ISWAP? So it's sort of a two-part question.
So I think, I mean, it's clear that we're seeing a lot of Russian influence in the Sahel region. We know that the Wagner Group has been playing around that area, particularly in Mali. And the interesting thing was that, you know, we saw civilians jubilating, you know, after the military takeover, and some of them were even waving Russian flags. So there's a clear Russian influence within that region. And of course, we do know that, I mean, geopolitics and all the things that are going on, yes, Africa has always been simmering as that next frontier. We've seen, you know, China been trying to gain a foothold and you know, making its mark, particularly across East Africa. Then we've seen, you know, the effects of Russia through the Wagner Group and things like that. I think that does portend concern because with, for example, when we look at the reaction to the coup in Niger, and with France leading the way and coming down very hard on the military regime, you know, and the US also towing the same line, and if most Western nations, it stands to reason that the military junta will feel isolated and they will be willing to, you know, swing to whoever is willing to give them a sympathetic ear. Guess what? Putin will be more than happy to one up the West by supporting them with arms, with whatever may help them at this point in time to feel like, okay, we have somebody who will back us. And that creates concerns. Yes, Nigeria has always tried to stay neutral and not lean one way or the other. But it will become even more interesting if Russia begins to gain a foothold very, very close to home, right on our borders. And I mean, it's interesting for us to see how we will react to such a situation. Everyone knows that even as we try to stay neutral, we lean more towards the West. Our business partnerships, our economic interests, you know, even military conversations have always leaned to the West. So that will create an interesting scenario. And I'm sure that, I mean, the Western nations would not be happy to see any Russian influence coming towards Nigeria, you know, given this size and the importance of Nigeria within that scenario. So I think that's definitely one to watch to see how that plays out.
Oh, and then the other question is, Bola Tinubu also doubles as the chair of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, the regional body that seems to regulate the affairs of countries in West Africa. And as chair, the reports are that a meeting was held a few hours ago, and they've given the military government in Niger 1 week to leave office, or the military option will be pursued against them. In your view, is the military route right for Nigeria? First of all, do you even think we have the capacity to enter into this venture? And secondly, is it wise to do so?
It's a great question you ask, because, I mean, we are dealing with a number of issues within our own borders, right? We still have ISWAP to deal with. We have the banditry. We have, the issues in the Southeast with all these attacks. So, I mean, and we've been talking for a while that our own security forces are stretched. Now, do we have the capacity to lead an interventionist force? I'm sure if we get others to chip in, we could lead such a force, but I would not believe, in my view, that we can, you know, single-handedly go in and go and try and do something. So perhaps with support, we send a few, 100,000 men or whatever it is, I mean, to augment a joint multinational force, you know, to do something, that's possible. But I think that has to be last resort. I think there needs to be, you know, diplomatic ways to get this military people to stand down and to restore democracy. That needs to be pursued first and foremost to a logical conclusion. But of course, the threat of force also helps. But it needs to be that it's not Nigeria solely trying to do anything. I mean, we have enough problems of our own.
Well, thank you. Interesting to see how that plays out, because I think online it says we have about 160,000 men in the Nigerian army. And as you've rightly pointed out, many of them are engaged in all kinds of security operations across the country, from the Niger Delta to banditry in the Middle Belt to Boko Haram and ISWAP in the Northeast and Northwest. So it'd be interesting to see where we find the troops to enter into this new adventure. But my final question on the topic of this Niger coup d'etat is, doesn't it indicate that the West's policy in West Africa is failing? Because a few people have pointed out the fact that many of these officers seem to have been trained in Western institutions, sometimes France, sometimes the US, some even in the UK. And they all seem to come home and then try to overthrow their government. So isn't that a sign that perhaps the West has failed? Or would you more likely blame African governments for failing as opposed to the West?
I think it's a local malaise. I know that we Africans tend to want to externalize our problems rather than take ownership for our own shortcomings. I don't think there's anything in Western military doctrine that tells people to come back to their home countries and come and seize power. But we have people who believe that, I mean, the gun that they carry gives them the right to rule and to go against the oath that they swore. So that for me is the real issue here. It has nothing to do with who trained them, because you might as well, I mean, if we take a wide look of how many countries, you know, send people to get trained, how many end up with coups. I mean, I'm sure it's not a majority that of people who get trained come back to be coup plotters. But I mean, there are people who just, you know, believe that this is, once they see an opportunity, they want. The interesting thing was that this same general that has taken over in Niger was at the head of beating back rebel officers 2 years ago. So what has changed? If he was doing the right thing 2 years ago, even with the same training, why has he turned now? So, you know, personal greed drives a lot of this stuff, and we really have to hold these guys to account and make sure that the despicable thing that they've done in plunging their country into crisis, they are held accountable for that and not allowed to hide on that the fact that they were trained by somebody.
Well, thank you, Phoenix. I think our time is up, but it'd be interesting to see. We'll be following this news developments in Niger closely because it's literally next door to Nigeria. Anyway, I'd first of all like to thank you again, Phoenix, for co-hosting. Thank you to our listeners. As Phoenix rightly said, I was in Nigeria for the week partying. Not quite partying, but yes, partying. My adopted father died, and we had the 40-day, was a Muslim, so we had the 40-day prayer event on Saturday. So it was a mixture of partying and prayers. But as I said on Twitter, I think the amount of partying I did on Saturday, I think I need 3 years to recover. But it was good being back again in Nigeria. The highlight of the event for me was arriving at the airport and seeing signs everywhere saying, "We don't, our officers don't accept bribes or extortion." And literally there were officers underneath every single sign demanding bribes from guests. So it was quite interesting to see that at the airport. So whoever's in charge of the airport, please, can we fix that place up? But anyway, until same time next week, I say have a fantastic 7 days to our listeners.
Thanks, Michael. Great to have you back. And I'm sure you'll soon be back partying. I know you very well for that. Thank you, listeners. Have a great week ahead. Cheers.